From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Cuba's tourist industry has been rocked by bombs over the last few months. Where are the condemnations? We'll have a debate. Thousands protest this week at the University of Texas, Austin, against a professor who says African American and Latino culture does not encourage achievement. And Mexican Americans fight the latest bid by the nuclear industry to dump its waste in West Texas. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Three key players in a scheme to funnel illegal contributions to Teamsters President Ron Kerry's re-election campaign pleaded guilty in federal court yesterday and agreed to cooperate with prosecutors. Two of them, in separate court appearances, implicated the Democratic National Committee, the Clinton-Gore campaign, and the AFL-CIO in the scheme. DNC and AFL-CIO officials denied trying to steer money to Kerry's campaign. Martin Davis, a Washington political consultant, and Jerry Nash, Kerry's former campaign manager, each pleaded guilty to conspiring to funnel union funds through political groups into Kerry's re-election bid last year against James P. Hoffa. Michael Ansara, the owner of a Massachusetts telemarketing firm known as Share that did business with the Teamsters, admitting creating a shell company that helped Davis and Nash carry out one of their plans to embezzle union funds. Specifically, Ansara pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy, Davis to one count of conspiracy, one count of embezzling union funds, and one count of mail fraud, and Nash to one count of conspiracy and a count of making false statements. Each count carries a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine, but sentencing was delayed as the three men cooperate with investigators. Media mogul Ted Turner yesterday announced he would give $1 billion over the next decade to a foundation to benefit United Nations charities. Turner made the announcement at a Times Square hotel in Manhattan, where he was receiving the Global Leadership Award from the United Nations Association of the United States of America, a nonprofit organization that backs the UN. The group praised Turner for improving international relations through news coverage on his cable news network and his advocacy on behalf of environment and human rights. Again, that's Ted Turner giving $1 billion to the United Nations. The number of AIDS cases diagnosed in the United States dropped last year for the first time in the 16-year history of the epidemic, a trend that federal officials attributed to aggressive new therapies that keep infected patients healthier, as well as the possibility that fewer people are becoming infected in the first place. Coupled with a report that the AIDS death rate dropped 23% from 1995 to the end of last year, experts called the downturn yet another encouraging sign that at least in the United States, the epidemic might at least be turning a corner. The diagnosis of AIDS made on the basis of a number of symptoms is a benchmark of sorts between the two other measures of the AIDS epidemic, infection with HIV, the virus that is believed to cause AIDS, and deaths from the full-fledged disease. These positive trends do, however, mask a troubling development. Cases among women and heterosexuals who do not use drugs, particularly minorities, are on the rise. A cloud of hydrogen sulfide gas has sent at least 45 people to hospitals in Detroit. Many of those seeking treatment yesterday were children from two elementary schools near the chemical plant that leaked the gas. Those who got sick complained of nausea, headaches, and vomiting. Both schools were closed for the day. The hydrogen sulfide gas leaked from the Quaker Chemical Company. A spokesperson says six of the plant's 62 workers showed symptoms of inhaling the gas. The company's investigating what it says was a minor release of hydrogen sulfide. It's a colorless, highly flammable gas that can irritate the eyes and mucous membranes. It's also known to cause nausea and headaches. The White House is defending experiments intended to find ways of stopping AIDS in the Third World. The studies on transmission of the disease from mother to child have been attacked as unethical by the New England Journal of Medicine. A journal editorial compared them to the notorious Tuskegee study, in which black men who had syphilis were denied penicillin without their knowledge. In the AIDS studies, groups of women are being given low-cost drug therapy, while other women got dummy pills for comparison purposes. White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry says the studies have been approved by ethical panels, and he says it's the only way affordable treatment will ever get to the poor women. And in other tests, federal health officials issued a rare clinical alert to the nation's doctors yesterday to announce the discovery of a treatment that prevents life-threatening strokes on children with sickle cell anemia, a debilitating blood disease that primarily affects blacks. The treatment is so dramatically effective, doctors said, they were compelled to halt a four-year study more than a year ahead of schedule so the therapy could quickly be offered to all of the estimated 2,500 American children who are most likely to benefit from it. But the treatment, which involves blood transfusions every 3 to 4 weeks for years and requires that children remain attached to a drug infusion pump for up to 12 hours, is uncomfortable. That's some of the news at this hour. I'm Amy Goodman for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Looking at the campaign finance story of the last few days, yesterday, businessman and mogul Roger Tamraz testified. He entertained the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee yesterday with a colorful and unapologetic account of how money buys high-level political access in Washington, and told the panel he would consider giving more money in the future to make sure he gained entree to the inner circles of government. Testifying without an attorney, Tamraz candidly told the committee that the only reason he contributed $300,000 to Democratic campaign committees and candidates during the 1996 election cycle was to gain access to senior government officials. At the time, he was promoting a plan to build an oil pipeline from the Caspian Sea region of Central Asia to Western markets. Tamraz succeeded in being invited to 6 functions at the White House, but he did not gain government support for the pipeline project or a formal private meeting with President Clinton, though he did get to see him. We're going to bring you this small exchange between Republican Senator Susan Collins and Roger Tamraz yesterday at the campaign finance abuse hearings.
You contributed after the interagency group had voted to deny you further access to high-level officials in the United States government. Did you believe that by making the contributions, it would allow you to have that access?
No, because if I really wanted access, I wouldn't just go to social functions. I mean, you must understand what these functions are about. You think you get into the White House, so you've won. It's only the fight begins when you get into the White House. Then there's a guerrilla fight to get close to the president.
Something you were successful in doing.
Well, let me finish my position. Uh-huh. First, the president is surrounded by the ladies because they swoon around him.
This one doesn't.
Well. Secondly, you have his bodyguards. And thirdly, you have the handlers. The same handlers that get you into the White House are sure once you get in that you don't get the chance to get what you want. They act like a basketball team professionally around the president, and anyone getting too close to the president is waltzed away. And I remember distinctly at one time, Don Fowler came and took me away when I had the chance to button the president.
But you were, in fact, successful in talking to the president about your pipeline project, were you not?
I think the record shows, ma'am, I'm a persistent person. I wouldn't be sitting here if I wasn't.
That's very true. Mr. Tamraz, one final question for you. It is difficult to get access to the President of the United States, and you've told us how it's difficult even once you're in the room to make your way to him. Do you believe that you would have been able to have the conversations, however brief they might have been, with the President of the United States about your pipeline project, a project in which you believe deeply, without having contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars to the DNC?
Honestly, no.
And that was international businessman Roger Tamraz responding to questions from Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine. She was doing that questioning at the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee yesterday as the campaign finance abuse hearings continue. Yes, you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez, who is a columnist with the New York Daily News. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy.
And today we're going to start off by talking about what's happening in Cuba. The Cuban government this week arrested a Salvadoran man in connection with a series of bombings that have rocked the Caribbean island's crucial tourist industry. Earlier this month, bombs were planted at three Havana hotels and a popular restaurant, killing an Italian tourist. Blasts earlier in the summer at the Hotel Capri and Hotel Nacional injured three others. The Cuban government has blamed forces in the United States for the attack, singling out the largest anti-Castro organization, the Cuban American National Foundation. We're joined now by the spokesperson for CAMF, the Cuban American National Foundation, Inosca Perez, speaking to us from Miami, Florida. We're also joined by Michael Ohini. He is the Cuba Project Director of the human rights group Global Exchange, which is based in San Francisco, California. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Well, why don't we start off with Michael Ohini and your concerns now about where the condemnations are coming from, or should I say, are not coming from. Tell us what's happened so far in Cuba.
We're pleased that following this last set of bombings, the bombings that you described in which the Italian businessman was killed, we're pleased that finally after several months of bombings, the State Department has made a condemnation of the bombings and has said, although in a watered-down statement, that it would assist the Cubans in investigating these crimes. We have concerns, though, about increased militancy coming from the exile community in Miami, in particular the Cuban American National Foundation. I should say right away that I definitely would not go as far as the Cuban government in terms of claiming any kind of link between the Cuban American National Foundation and the bombings. However, we do have serious concerns about the foundation's support of the bombings. On August 13th, the foundation came out in a full-page ad saying that it respected the bombings as an expression of internal will for the change of the Cuban people. Obviously, now we've found out that this is not a Cuban person that's taking credit for these bombings, and so we have concern that a group in the position of the Cuban American National Foundation is able to make these statements without any kind of statements of concern coming from our own government.
I'd like to bring in Inosca Perez and ask her, what is the response of your organization to the charges of the Cuban government, and what is your view of these other bombings, given this country's position against terrorist bombings in other parts of the world?
Yes, thank you, Juan, and good day to Amy. And let me clarify that, first of all, Mr. Ohini has not said the truth about what our position is. And let me clarify a few things. First of all, the State Department did condemn the bombings since the first day in April when it happened. On the other hand, so has the foundation condemned violence and has been in the forefront of condemning violence in Cuba and the United States, and also calling for a peaceful transition in Cuba. What the foundation said in that statement was that, taking into consideration the fact that the Cuban government has had to endure a dictatorship for the last 38 years, that they have a right to choose whatever means are necessary for them inside Cuba to put an end to a dictatorship, the same way that other countries have waged wars or done whatever they have deemed necessary. It is the right of every country. It was even stated in the Declaration of Independence that countries have the right to rebellion when they endure oppression. That is what we meant in that statement. Never did we did we support the bombings, and always have we been against violence.
Well, I'd like to ask Michael Ohini, in terms of the tourist industry in Cuba, obviously has been growing and has surpassed now the sugarcane industry as the main source of foreign export earnings. Do you have any sense of what the impact of these bombings has been already on the tourist industry, or what impact it could have on Cuba's continuing economic problems?
It really remains to be seen. Of course, the Cuban government had serious concerns about the effect that it may have. As you may know, the first bombings, while reported, were not confirmed by the Cuban government. Like I said, it really does remain to be seen, though, whether this will have a significant impact on tourism. It's been growing at an amazing rate over the last several years. And, at this point, there hasn't been major fallout from the bombings. But we'll see, certainly, in the coming months.
And in terms of a general reaction among the Cuban communities across the United States, Ms. Perez, how has that been, or has there been much focus or attention on these bombings here in this country among Cuban Americans?
Well, of course, there has been a lot of attention on these bombings, especially the fact that there is a man who is being held in Cuba, not the first one. First, they arrested a German. Then, after protests from Germany, he was released. Then it was a Portuguese who, it turned out that the nitroglycerin they found in his hands were his medication for a heart condition. Now, the next comedy is that some colonel from counterintelligence in Cuba sits in front of a TV set and has this man, who is perfectly calm, assuming the blame for all these bombs. Now, the United States has repeatedly said, where is the evidence? And they have not come forth with any evidence other than the one they have made up. And Cuba is a country where there are no legal guarantees for anybody. You also have to realize that the Cuban people, after 38 years, must be very tired of having to put up with the fact that, for example, hotels in Cuba, which are built by foreigners and Cubans are not allowed to own, are only open for tourists, and Cubans are not allowed into hotels. This is called apartheid, segregation. You also have to realize that this same Cuban man has to endure the fact that 13-year-old girls are being taken around by tourists with dollars, and that children in Cuba do not get milk after 7 years old, not because there is an embargo, because tourists in hotels get fresh meals. I think that's enough to make Cubans angry as to what the tourist industry is doing to them.
Ninoska Perez, a spokesperson for the Cuban American National Foundation in Miami. Michael Ohini, your response from Global Exchange out in San Francisco.
On the Cubans sharing evidence on the bombings, first of all, this is a relatively new arrest. You know, they've come out with some evidence. They have say they have a confession. I agree that it is frustrating that the Cubans have not come forward. However, I think we have to recognize that this is all happening not in the context of normal relations between the two countries. Cuba and the United States have very minimal diplomatic contacts, and so the process for that happening would be quite difficult. Number two, I think we have to recognize that the United States government throughout the last 37 years hasn't exactly had the best record when it comes to apprehending and prosecuting people who have perpetrated acts of terror against the state of Cuba. I'm not in any way surprised that the Cubans would be hesitant to share evidence with the United States. In the last several months alone, there have been several cases where the United States has refused to send hijackers back to Cuba who have hijacked planes and brought them to this country. And those two of them, at least, who were prosecuted were acquitted in U.S. courts of hijacking, despite the fact that it was a clear-cut case of hijacking.
I'd like to ask Ms. Perez, obviously your organization has always opposed normalization of relations between the United States and Cuba. In light of the fact that our country has extensive relations and official relations with both the People's Republic of China and with Vietnam, where 55,000 Americans lost their lives in a war recently, how do you see the Cuban situation as distinct from what is happening, for instance, with the People's Republic of China or with Vietnam?
Well, the fact that the United States has interest with the Republic of China and trades with them, despite the fact that it's political prisoners and children who do hard labors in those factories, doesn't make it right to give it a status of preferred nation. On the other hand, Cuba is a country where serious crimes are committed every day. The sinking of a tugboat in the Bay of Havana with children on board, where it's not what we say, but what the survivors have said. The downing of civilian planes with American citizens on board that has been proven before United Nations that they were in international airspace. Those hijackers that Mr. Ohini is talking about, they have not been convicted in U.S. courts because they have not been accused of hijacking under legal terms because they piloted their own planes. They did not force anybody to come to the United States. So that is where the difference lies. However, prisons in Cuba are full. Fidel Castro has shown no willingness to change, no desire to hold elections. So why should the United States have to have relations with a country that is doing this every day and doesn't feel that it has to change its attitude of violating human rights on a daily basis.
We're going to continue this discussion after the break. We're also going to talk about the role of the Cuban American National Foundation in this country and who Jorge Mascanosa is, the head of the Cuban American National Foundation, also a big part of Radio Martí, U.S. government radio broadcast that goes into Cuba. We're talking to Nonoska Perez, spokesperson for the Cuban American National Foundation in Miami, and Michael Ohini, Cuba Project Director of the human rights group Global Exchange in San Francisco. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the ruler. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and we're just going to wrap up our conversation on Cuba with Michael Ohini, human rights group Global Exchange is his organization in San Francisco, whose Cuba project director returned from Cuba in April. Nonoska Perez, the spokesperson for the Cuban American National Foundation, the largest anti-Castro group in this country, headed by Jorge Mascanosa. Well, Michael Ohini, why don't you tell us about your research on CAMF? Tell us about your research there. We're having a little trouble getting them on. We'll go to a little music break, and then we'll come back. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As I said before, I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. We're having a little trouble with the phone lines, which will mean we wrap up this discussion of the bombings in Cuba that have taken place. But I think the essential points got across from Michael Ohini of Global Exchange based in San Francisco and Nonoska Perez of the Cuban American National Foundation. Before we move to our next segment, where we're going to be talking to the head of the African and African American Studies Department at the University of Texas, Austin, Sheila Walker, to talk about what has transpired there over the last week, where thousands of students have protested the comments of a professor talking about the inferiority of Black and Latino culture. Juan, I wanted to ask you something that we heard earlier in the news, and that is the issue of the AFL-CIO, the DNC, and the indictments yesterday of the three political consultants, at least their pleas, who allegedly used various groups, including the Democratic National Committee, the AFL-CIO, to illegally funnel money to help finance Teamsters President Ron Kerry's reelection campaign.
Yeah, well, I think this is definitely a major blow to the labor movement, as the organized labor has been beginning now to resurrect itself, to have something like this occur now. Clearly, Ron Carey is in deep trouble as the head of the Teamsters, and in all likelihood, it seems that he will not be able to run again in new elections for president of the Teamsters. But even worse are the allegations now by these consultants who have pled guilty and are cooperating that there was some scheme or attempt between organized labor and the Democratic National Committee to, in essence, launder funds, in essence, get contributions into the AFL while the AFL granted, or contributions to the Teamsters while the AFL gave money to the Democratic National Committee. And I think even though it appears that the quid pro quo in this situation did not actually take place, just the idea that that organized labor or some sections of organized labor were in such direct relationship and coordination of plans with the Democratic National Committee, whose own methods are clearly suspect at this point, creates all kinds of problems for everyday labor organizers and activists in the workplace when they're trying to talk about fighting for a new type of labor movement.
You know, it's also interesting, aside from the illegal aspects of it, just the legal part of it is this very close relationship between the Teamsters, between Citizen Action and the Democratic National Committee. I mean, just that they were cooperating in this way.
Well, yeah, that in itself, I think Citizen Action has a lot of explaining to do to people who have looked to it as a group that was always at the forefront of issues like campaign finance reform.
I mean, that's the incredible part, that they're leading on the issue, working with Public Campaign and other groups on campaign finance reform.
Yeah, this is a scandal of the do-gooders in the terms of the fact that they apparently felt, if these charges are proven, which they still need to be proven, that they apparently felt that any means necessary to accomplish what they perceived to be as just aims would be allowed. And I think that it creates all kinds of problems for the progressive movement in this country. And, of course, the right wing and the Republicans in Congress will have a field day with these new scandals.
You know, it's interesting, during the campaign finance abuse hearings, subpoenas were issued to a number of groups, from the AFL-CIO to, on the right, the Christian Coalition. But now there's this coalition of groups from the right to the left who are outraged by these subpoenas, that don't want to have to bring all their records forward and testify before the campaign finance abuse hearings. So the AFL may have some unusual bedfellows.
Yes, and, you know, there have been some folks who have said that this is a new form of McCarthyism that is occurring with these various hearings, and no doubt a lot of it is from the point of view of the most extreme sections of the Republican Party. But it seems to me the difference with these hearings versus the McCarthy hearings of the 1950s or these congressional investigations is that in those days they were going after people for what they believed and what how they were organizing. And here, all of this has been about how you raised money and how you spent money and who you gave money to. So it's really all of the ideological basis of what this assault is about has been lost in the modern way that people are approaching politics, which is all about raising money and spending money.
Now, what about the future of Ron Carey? Yes, he's in deep trouble already. There's a runoff election, or just an election again, between him and Jimmy Hoffa, son of the late and notorious Teamsters president, Jimmy Hoffa. It looks like now it could be that Ron Carey will not even be allowed to run.
Yeah, I would say if I were going to bet right now, I would say that he is not going to be running for president of the Teamsters, and that the progressive wing of the Teamsters has to begin to figure out who they are going to unite behind to be able to oppose Jimmy Hoffa Jr. in a second go-around.
Well, we'll certainly see what happens. And if he wasn't able to run against Jimmy Hoffa, what, they would put someone else up against him?
Oh, yes. I mean, they'd have to come up with somebody else from within the progressive ranks of the Teamsters to do that. But I think that the odds are pretty slim right now for Carey to run for again.
Well, we will always continue to follow that as we have. We're going to take a short musical break, and then we're going to go to our next segment, which involves the University of Texas at Austin. Some may have heard about it, others may not have. Thousands of people protesting. After that, in our last segment, we're going to talk about nuclear waste from nuclear plants in Vermont and Maine, and how if Congressmember Bernie Sanders has his way and the nuclear industry has their way, we'll be headed to West Texas, and we're going to hear about Mexican Americans who are fighting the transport of nuclear waste to their communities. So do stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In what campus police called one of the largest demonstrations in recent memory, thousands of University of Texas students this week protested racist remarks by a law professor. Professor Lino Graglia told a news conference last week that Black and Mexican-American students are culturally inferior and not academically competitive with white students. He said Blacks and Mexican-Americans are not academically competitive with whites in selective institutions. He added, "I'm not expert on these causes, but it is the result of cultural effects. These cultures do not encourage achievement. Failure is not looked upon with disgrace." Coming in the wake of the abolition of affirmative action at the University of Texas, the remarks caused an uproar. An estimated 5,000 students rallied on Tuesday with civil rights leader Reverend Jesse Jackson, who called law school professor Graglia a national disgrace. Jackson called on students to isolate Graglia by avoiding his classes. He said the administration should reassign the professor and keep him away from students. We're joined right now by Professor Sheila Walker. She's a professor of anthropology and the director of the Center for African and African American Studies at the University of Texas, Austin. She is at an Africana Studies conference up at Cornell University in New York, and we speak to her there. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Walker.
Thank you very much.
Well, can you tell us about what has happened over the last week at the University of Texas?
Well, I guess several things have happened. There's been a good deal of publicity of the pros and the cons. There are actually a few people who support Graglia's statements, not just his right to make them under his First Amendment rights, but the majority of the people who've spoken up, including the university administration and the majority of Graglia's colleagues in the law school, as well as other departments, have criticized his remarks, have called them not only irresponsible, but inaccurate. And I think that that's maybe a major issue. Someone who's supposed to be a professor of law, in which evidence is allegedly an important issue, allows himself to make statements and saying, "I don't know what the causes are, but these are the causes, and they're guilty." I mean, that's the shocking part of his behavior. It's not shocking that he's a racist, although he says his racist remarks shouldn't tag him as a racist. But there's the issue of evidence. What's his evidence? He doesn't seem obliged to marshal any evidence in favor of his irresponsible remarks.
Well, Professor Walker, clearly he's got a right to believe whatever he wants. The question involved here is to what degree the university provides him either a forum or has its institutional backing to some of his viewpoints. So what's your view in terms of this whole issue of the relationship between his free speech and the responsibilities of the university to combat racism of this type?
Well, I think that is a major issue. Obviously, he has the right to free speech, and he has academic freedom. We all are supposed to have academic freedom. However, The university also condemns racial harassment, and there are African-American and Mexican-American students who feel that what he is doing is racial harassment. The university also presumably condemns hate speech, and I believe many people consider his remarks to constitute hate speech. Additionally, one of the members of the administration said that she would not suggest that students boycott Graglia's classes, as suggested by Reverend Jesse Jackson, because of the educational value of them. I thought that was amazingly ironic. Now, the university says that it wants to promote diversity, and this is a good opportunity for them to use Graglia's remarks as an occasion to say, okay, we condemn his remarks and this is what we're going to do to promote diversity, as opposed to just saying, well, we don't agree with him.
Now, is it true that he teaches a course on race relations? Is that accurate? I thought I read that somewhere. I mean,
yeah, I haven't read that. he apparently teaches constitutional law. That's what I'm aware of.
And it's clear that he claims that he has been espousing these views for the past 30 years. Why is it now that suddenly there's so much focus or attention, and why hasn't there been focus or attention on his views in the past?
I don't know why there hasn't been in the past. It's hard to say why things didn't happen before. Perhaps this is, first of all, it seems to me that he has this is a window of opportunity for people who want to be more public about their racism, given Hopwood. I mean, Hopwood and the reversal of affirmative action attempts at the University of Texas, I think, creates a climate in which people who hold racist views feel that they can express them freely because the university policy now supports them.
Professor Walker, for people who are not familiar with Hopwood, Gralia, the professor at the University of Texas who made the comments, made them Wednesday at a news conference where students announced the formation of a group to support the court ruling that banned affirmative action at the university. And Gralia is the honorary co-chair of the group called Students for Equal Opportunity. Yes, they were talking about the Hopwood decision that came down in Louisiana. Can you explain what that is?
The Hopwood decision was brought, the Hopwood case was brought against the University of Texas for alleged reverse discrimination. There were four white women who said that they were denied access to, or were denied acceptance at the law school of the University of Texas, and that minorities with lower scores on standardized tests were admitted in their place. Now, it seems to me that what the equal opportunity that Students for Equal Opportunity is saying is equal opportunity for white people, whatever their level of qualification, equal opportunity for them to occupy all of the positions in the law school.
And what has been the result since that decision in terms of the university? Because for those listeners who have not been keeping abreast of this?
The result has been a radical decline in the number of African-American applicants and acceptances at the law school, as well as a decline in the number of African American and Mexican American students in the university.
Well, Professor Walker, I guess there was, in many ways, a direct attack on you, because one of the things that Gralia said is that part of this whole inferiority is that it was proven by the fact that students take Black studies, African American studies, rather than science courses.
Right. I thought that was an interesting comparison. He said they take Black studies instead of chemistry, a core course like chemistry, which is great for understanding human relations. I think that that was a wonderful example of Professor Gralia's total lack of respect for evidence. There are indeed many students at the University of Texas who take African-American studies and don't take chemistry. There are those who take both. Many African-American students take both. But what Professor Gralia failed to mention was that the majority of the people who teach African-American studies courses, just like the overwhelming majority of the students in all of the African-American studies courses, are not African-Americans. They are white people. Mm-hmm. They are white people who've decided that they want a sense of reality based on the complex and multi-ethnic society in which they live. Several of my white students said, thank you for speaking for us.
I understand that you're at an Africana Studies conference now up at Cornell University, which is an international conference. People from Cuba, from Africa, from Latin America, from around the United States will be there for the weekend. Is this going to be an issue that is raised?
Not necessarily. Well, I don't know. I don't know if it will be raised specifically. But if we're talking about education in the Americas, there'll be people here from Brazil, for example. And Brazil is kind of similar to the United States in that affirmative action is an issue. People of Afro-Brazilian, people of African descent in Brazil have been denied access to education less than in the United States. But they're facing the same sorts of issues, so it may come up.
What about this whole viewpoint that Gralia expressed, which is a common viewpoint among, unfortunately, a large segment of the white Americans in this country, that there are cultural bases in the lack of attention to education that occurs within the black and Latino communities, that failure is not considered a disgrace, as he said.
Yeah, I think that, well, first of all, I think that that's sort of an amazing allegation about so many millions of people. And I'm not quite sure what his basis of information is, but that doesn't seem to matter. Information doesn't seem to matter. What he referred to, or the issue has been referred to, of African-Americans and Mexican-Americans not doing well on standardized tests and therefore not being admissible by the same criteria to university education. If standardized tests were indeed culture blind, which strikes me as absolutely impossible because they're about achievement of a certain kind of cultural orientation and certain kinds of cultural data, then there wouldn't be an issue. I think there is a realism among African Americans and Mexican Americans that the cards are stacked against all of us because of institutionalized racism. However, I think that to claim that two entire populations don't value education, given the kinds of sacrifices that many people have made to get an education in a hostile environment, is absolutely outrageous.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Sheila Walker, for joining us, professor of anthropology and director of Center for African and African American Studies at the University of Texas, Austin, which has seen one of the largest demonstrations in its history this past week over the issue of affirmative action, particularly the comments of a law school professor around the abilities of Black and Latino students. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we're going to continue in Texas in just a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The nuclear industry is facing another tough battle in Congress. The House of Representatives is now considering a bill to authorize the dumping of low-level radioactive waste from nuclear reactors in Vermont and Maine to a site in West Texas. But opponents of the measure have launched a spirited campaign against the latest nuclear dump site. We're joined in West Texas by Maria Mendez, a longtime resident of Hudspeth County, the site of the proposed nuclear waste dump, and in Washington, D.C., joined by Diane DiRigo, who is the Radioactive Waste Project Director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Center, which is an advocacy group in the nation's capital. Diane DiRigo, why don't we start with you? Can you sort of put the particular battle that we'll find out from Maria Mendez about in a national context?
Yes. The first thing that's most important to understand is that low-level, so-called low-level radioactive waste includes very long-lasting and intensely radioactive components and resins and filters from nuclear power. And in some cases, this material is even more radioactive than the high-level waste from weapons production. So it's not just the medical booties and gloves that are often touted by proponents. So what we're dealing with is something very significant and dangerous. The national law right now, the national policy, is for states to take care of the waste that's generated by private nuclear industries. And some states have bucked that. Some states are not going to do it. However, Texas has gone along with the plan, has sited a dump in West Texas, a location for a dump, and is proceeding to assist the nuclear power industry in pretending that this problem doesn't exist. They would take waste from Maine, Vermont, and pretty likely the rest of the country to dump in this small community. There are battles like this waging in California, Native American land at Ward Valley, in the lowest income county in Nebraska, in northern Nebraska. Ranchers and farmers are fighting a similar dumping proposal. There are proposals around the country. I call it radioactive roulette. Whichever dump opens first is most likely to be the dump for the country, for the nuclear power industry. It shifts liability from the nuclear industry to the taxpayers in the state.
And there seem to be questions not only about states trying to get rid of their own responsibility, but also a general trend towards siting many of these hazardous waste dumps in minority communities. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. The richer communities with more political clout have been able to oust the threat of these nuclear, so-called low-level nuclear waste dumps, and it seems that the communities with the least amount of money are often communities of people of color and least amount of political clout are ending up with the targets of these dumps. In West Texas, as Maria can describe more firsthand, the community is relatively low income, 40% below the poverty level, average family personal income less than $8,000 a year. The more than 67%, 70% of the population is Mexican American, and the same kind of dynamic is seen in California and Ward Valley. It's Native American land, sacred to five Native nations, Aboriginal land. Both of these sites are proximal to important rivers, the Colorado River in the case of California, the Rio Grande in Texas.
Well, let's get Maria Mendez into this conversation. Maria, can you tell us your story in Hudspeth County, which is the site of the proposed nuclear waste dump?
Okay. Good day, everybody.
Good day.
Yes, it's 5 miles from the small town of Sierra Blanca, and it's about 10 miles from my home where I live in Alamore. And it's on top of a earthquake line, and there's a big fault underneath, and our aquifers meet there, you know. So this is one thing that we are trying to stop, because it will ruin not only that, but also the Rio Grande, which is about 14 or 16 miles from the site. And, they've been lying to us, you know, that it's only medical waste. But so far we have found out that it's not true, you know, and people thought that that's what it was. So, but now that, you know, everybody's scared, afraid because of what's going to be brought down here. And I think that's a great injustice to us.
Maria Mendez, tell us about your family's history.
Yes, and my family has lived here for all our lives. In my family, we're victims of radiation. That's why I am here, you know, to tell the people why this is so terrible, you know, because we had a life of 44 years of pain and suffering from radiation.
What do you mean? Radiation from where?
My husband was in World War II, and he was in the Pacific, the coast of Japan, you know, when they dropped the Hiroshima bomb. And, you know, after that, he came home, and we didn't know he had been affected until, you know, we didn't even know. We were married. I lost three babies. I had three miscarriages. I couldn't have any children. So we went to the doctor to see what was wrong with us, and he said, no, there's nothing with either one of you. We're perfectly healthy, except that he had some unusual in his blood. His blood was good, but there was something, and we never pay attention to that until our fourth child, you know, I was able to have, and she was born with a birth defect. She has a tumor from her right toe all the way up to her left kidney, which led to have her right leg amputated when she was 13 years old. And after that, she's been in and out of hospital. She's had more surgery. Some parts of the tumor have been removed, but they cannot remove the whole thing. And she goes in and out. You know, she gets fevers very often, and she gets kinds of sores. And this has been our life for a whole family. And all my other children, my other seven children, have been affected one way or the other. The second daughter, she couldn't carry her second and third babies full term because her body started rejecting it. And they didn't know why. You know, she had the first child and she was okay. So after that, the second child had to be, she had to have a cesarean. And he was born with a cerebral palsy because they waited too long to get him out. So now I'm not saying that was caused by the radiation. That was because of they didn't take him out as soon as they found out that she was going to miscarry the baby. So his brain is okay. He's a smart boy, but his body, he drags himself on the floor. He can't walk. His right side is almost paralyzed, but he's beginning to have some therapy on that. And all the others have had to go into the hospital when they were babies. We had them for whatever, I don't know, there was a lot of other problems that they had. Well, and my husband can't have any dental work done because of his strontium 90 in his bones.
From World War II?
Yes.
So, Maria Mendez, in essence, you have had to live with the effects of radiation from your husband's exposure in World War II. So when you realized that this dump was really a dump for radioactive waste, what did you do? Did you get actively then involved in the campaign against it?
I started going out, but I was kind of reluctant to talk about our situation because some people don't believe it, you know, and I did not want to expose my family to any public scrutiny. Mm-hmm. So I kept quiet until now. I'm talking because this is so dangerous and it's a very sad life. We had our happy moments, you know, but it's been very painful for everybody seeing their sister suffer the way she has. It's very, you know, it's hard on all the family, even including our grandkids. They wonder why and they wonder if they're going to have any children like that. And I said, I pray and hope that you don't. Maybe if we had known about this, we wouldn't have had all our children. But I guess God had his ways of getting us so he can help to save this world.
Maria,
yes?
Since your husband is an atomic veteran, and there are thousands and thousands of them, whether they're those who were put right next to the nuclear blasts in this country, the atomic tests, to see how they would affect their bodies, or those in the Pacific, as your husband was, is he getting any kind of compensation? I mean, that commission that Hazel O'Leary set up, the former Department of Energy secretary, where some people are getting compensation, is your husband among them?
No, we're not getting any compensation, and we're not looking for any compensation. We're not fighting for, you know, of course we need to work, we need the money, but everybody's, all we care is just to stop this nuclear menace, you know, that we have all over the world. We don't want it for anybody because we know the pain that you have to go through with it.
Have you testified in Texas against the nuclear industry putting this nuclear waste dump in your community in West Texas?
Yes, I was with, when we had the hearings, you know, I went and I testified and I told them. That's when I started coming out and some of my friends didn't even know about it, you know, and they said, well, I never talk about it because, you know, it was so painful. But yes, I did when we had the hearings where they're looking for the license for the dump from the TNRCC.
Yeah, I'd like to bring Diane D'Arrigo back into the conversation here. This attempt to site this dump appears to be even in violation of accords between Mexico and the United States over the siting of hazardous dumps close to the Rio Grande River. Could you explain that, and how is it possible that Congress is passing or considering passing a law that would violate an agreement between the two countries?
Well, the 1983 La Paz Agreement with Mexico is one in which both countries agreed not to put new sources of pollution within 100 kilometers or 60 miles of the border. This appears to be pretty clear violation of that agreement. The proponents of the dump don't seem to care. They say that it's only an agreement, it's not a treaty. There is a possibility of legal action to follow regarding that. There has been a civil rights complaint filed against the U.S. Department of Energy, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the states of Vermont, Texas, and Maine for violating Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. It also appears to violate the president's 1994 order on environmental justice. And there are resolutions that have passed all along the border from all but two counties in Texas have resolutions opposing the project. Both states of in Mexico on the border, Coahuila and Chihuahua, are opposing, have resolutions opposing the project. The cities of Juarez and El Paso and a number of the counties in Texas are intervening in the licensing process. The state has essentially approved the license. Interveners, over 20 of them, have intervened and opposed, contested the license. And that process, which appears very rigged in favor of the project, is being contested with very expensive legal procedures.
So then how is it possible that with all of this opposition that the nuclear industry has not only been able to get this bill to Congress, but also apparently has the support of Congressman Sanders, who's supposed to be one of the most progressive members of that?
Founder of the Progressive Caucus.
The founder of the Progressive Caucus?
Yeah, it's rather unfortunate. However, the reality is that the nuclear waste from Vermont would possibly leave his area, and that's his first commitment, is to get it out of his area. I've spoken with Mr. Sanders, and he agrees. We should never have made this waste, but we've got it, and we don't want it here in Vermont.
Sheila, well, let me just ask you, Diane DiRigo, what is the alternative? What is the, for example, the Nuclear Information and Resource Center proposing?
Well, we would advocate, of course, stopping the creation of more waste, for which there's no solution, and for that which has been generated, it must be stored and managed and recontainerized for its entire hazardous life. We can't pretend that we bury it, that it's out of sight and out of mind. It's going to leak wherever it's left, and sticking it into a community that does not have the resources to effectively stop the dump, obviously, is not going to have the resources to effectively oversee the dump and get remedial action when it's necessary, when the dump starts leaking. So it makes no sense to transport waste 2,600 miles down the eastern seaboard and across the central part of the country to dump in a ditch in the waterways near the waterways of an international boundary on an earthquake risk.
Diane, can you tell us the number of this Senate bill, House bill? And can you let us know who are the people you think are important to contact? Perhaps the phone number of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service if people want to get involved.
Yeah, the bill number is H.R. 629 in the House, H.R. 629. And in the Senate, it's S-270. And we would ask for, I live in the district, so I don't have any representatives or senators but who can vote, but I would ask all of those who have representatives and senators to contact them to ask them to vote against this unjust, environmentally unjust bill, H.R. 629 and S-270, the Texas Nuclear Waste Compact.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, both Diane DiRigo and Maria Mendez. Also give out the number of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service in Washington, D.C. It's 202-328-0002. 202-328-0002. And if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call the Pacifica Archives and order a cassette copy. The number is 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Maria Mendez, thanks for being with us from West Texas, and Diane DiRigo. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Dred Scott Keyes is our engineer in New York. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And tune in on Monday. We'll be joined by Marcia Gillespie and Gloria Steinem for the 25th anniversary of Ms. Magazine.